This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Living free.
Thanks to the Resident Frequency Radio crew for another great show, playing tracks and chatting with Collingwood artists. Welcome to Living Free, a one-hour show in which we highlight one of the many programs that assist in recovery from drugs, alcohol, gambling and food addictions. Our guests share their recovery story and highlight that shared experience saves lives. You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 on your AM dial, 3CR digital, or even, you know, maybe you're live streaming on 3cr.org.au. My name's Michael. And I'm joined in the studio by my guest today, Don. Thanks for coming in, Don.
Thank you, Michael.
Excellent. And he's going to share his experience of recovery from alcoholism with the help of Alcoholics Anonymous. Before we do that, I'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, traditional owners of the land from which 3CR transmits people-powered radio. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and acknowledge that this land was stolen and sovereignty was never ceded. Also, please note that the Living Free show may involve discussion of topics such as suicide, mental illness, self-harm or family violence. So please consider your well-being and that of others whilst listening. As I said, welcome into the studio. We'd like to start the show by asking our guests to tell us a little bit about their upbringing or their childhood. So what was it like growing up as Don?
Thanks, Michael. Don, an alcoholic. As I look, my childhood wasn't particularly dysfunctional, I don't think. There was, I was born in Hobart in the mid-60s, and, you know, we moved around a lot with Dad's work, my father's work, and, you know, there was, I wasn't in Hobart for long, then we moved to Launceston, and then he got transferred to Warrnambool, so I came to the mainland when I was, you know, pretty young, but there was still kind of family, you know, extended family in Tasmania, you know. So moving from, like, even then it was from kindergarten to school. We stayed in Warrnambool for, I don't know, 3 years or something, as I remember, as a child. And, you know, there was a problem with Dad was in finance, and he got involved in a bad deal and, bad debt, and he lent money to a friend, and it was all above board, but his friend's checks began to bounce, and, you know, my father got in trouble, and then it was, you know, he lost the job, and then there was debt. And so we moved to Melbourne when I was 10 years old, and there was, you know, it was all kind of never really spoken about, but there was this issue with money and Dad. Dad got a new job in the car industry, and so I'd moved a few times then, you know. And I think in hindsight, perhaps that's why there's been a sort of a bit of a disconnection. I find sometimes and moving around and not able to sort of anchor in anywhere, and, you know, perhaps that was a component. And then we moved again houses around the eastern suburbs with rent and you know, owners selling the houses, et cetera. So, you know, there wasn't really an established house until kind of the mid-80s. And
so who's we? Who's in your family?
That's like my father, my mother and my brother.
Cool. Older or younger brother?
Younger brother. Yeah. Yeah, he was, he's 3 or 4 years younger than me. Yeah, so that was kind of life then. You know, as a child too, I was quite sort of introverted. I thought, you know, I was very shy, very bookish, kind of lived in a sort of fantasy world, read a lot of comics, and there was a lot of science fiction and all that kind of escapism, which was, even back then, it was kind of deemed a bit odd, I think, but, you know, there wasn't a lot of other kids doing it. You know, everyone was out kind of playing sport, and, you know, I always felt a bit awkward with all that kind of activity. But, you know, I got through. And then, you know, there was high school, and then sort of high school, sort of, you know, I was kind of established. Well, by the time we got established, as in, you know, living situation, by the time I got to high school, and I kind of, high school life was very awkward too. You know, I had some friends, and you know, there was a few kind of betrayals and issues, and that happened through that, which I guess happens to everybody. And then I gravitated to some friends that were had been around the block, and
older.
Oh no, they were of the same age, but had a different kind of perhaps. Some of them were had experimented with drinking, and you know, I was still 14, 15, 16. I really hadn't gone down that path as yet.
You hadn't discovered the elixir of life.
I hadn't discovered the elixir of life. I was, still quite naive. And I had some, I was always sort of an amiable sort of kid too. You know, I wasn't a loner as much, but I wasn't in the in crowd. But I wasn't with the unwanted kids, put it that way. I was sort of a middle-level kind of kid. And, I had some friends that were Christians, and I played basketball with them, and they were really kind of nice, understanding, kind of gentle kind of people, I guess. But I moved away from them when I discovered this new crowd and a new group of friends, put it that way. And, then the drinking started.
Cool. So how old were you then?
I was 16 when I had my first proper drink.
Proper.
I dabbled a few times. I had a few drinks here and there. And I grew up too as a kid in the 70s. My parents were, people of that era, I guess. There was, more people were getting more progressive, and there was, a lot of drinking going around. I was always exposed to it. There was, kind of parties and barbecues, and I saw a kind of lot of drunkenness around me, and I was not repelled by it, but I accepted it. But it wasn't...
Wasn't messy. It was just social
drinking. Social drinking, but there were moments that happens. There's things, embarrassing things seeing your parents do, but... It wasn't. There was no hostility.
There's therapy for that.
but there was no hostility or family violence or anything like that. There was just kind of things got a bit. It was a few shameful things that I was exposed to. But your parents dancing and walking around saying strange things that it was. But I don't know if that really affected me or not. But it there was something about it that made me feel uncomfortable at the same time.
Yeah, fair enough. So if you're if you're in your mid teens when you've discovered it, so did you drink because you didn't fit in? Did you drink because did it make you feel more comfortable?
Oh, definitely. When I had that first proper drink with a few friends, I think my parents were away, and my mates came over, and we had a few VBs one night, and that experience of that night, there was something that happened that just transformed me. I felt this ease and comfort that came with that. This ability to sort of feel comfortable and project onto others what I thought they wanted me to be, and just a kind of sense of joy that was with.
It's amazing, isn't it? So when we talk about it, Alcoholics Anonymous, we're about this, the spiritual experience that we're looking for in doing the program, but the spiritual experience that comes from that feeling you have when that first time you have it, and you go, oh my God, where has this been?
Yes, exactly. And that quite quickly, I obviously gravitated to it. I became obsessed with it, and I thought I could, even then I thought I could perhaps manage it. And, it wasn't three bottles of vodka a night after that. It was...
isn't it? I started with a bottle of vodka.
But it was parties and bad behaviour that came with that too. So there were parties that were going on by the time, we're in our 16 years of age, fourth form, fifth form and all that. People were having parties and parents were going away and we'd crash parties and... the word was around who was having what, and you'd be invited to parties, and generally even then, like, the drinking's got out of control, and there was behavioural issues that go with that. There was a certain hostility that I was involved in, and there was, even at school, there was police involvement and locked up and taken away and kind of all that sort of business started to happen. And so even then I could pinpoint a lot of problematic issues because of my drinking, but I assumed that would level out somehow.
Yeah, grow out of that. Fix it up. So when did it sort of start to become a problem? How did you finance it?
I was working part-time And that also there was a lot of thieving going on.
There was the crime, crime and alcohol. I'm shocked.
Yeah, there was just things like the, my father's port bottle, port barrel.
Yep.
And you know, I'd take fill up the soft drink bottle and take it to a party full of port and things. You know, kind of stuff like that. I always get my hands on it. And so people would buy it for me too sometimes, but it was generally like once I got that part time job in a supermarket, even then. My money was going towards booze.
Yeah, I get that. That's my experience.
And also all that other kind of interest dropped off too. You know, my focus changed into drinking, the pub, girls, music. You know, kind of a shift. I was always into music, but the kind of science fiction, comic booky kind of world also ended once I went. And I thought that was...
Growing up.
Yeah, growing up, a transitional thing too, yeah.
Wow, cool. Okay, so and did it get, like, was it problematic? Like, did it, are you living with your parents still? Or
yes, it was problematic. There was concerns about me drinking and I got suspended from school for drinking on an excursion.
I love that. That's great.
You know, I was quite. I remember like drinking with friends, and you know, by then, a couple of years in, or so, or a year in, or something. You know, we're going out drinking. You know, stealing booze from parents and all that, and also, you know, putting our money together. And I remember drinking like half a bottle of Southern Comfort, and you know, the next, and on top of X amount of beers, and the. Almost alcohol poisoning. I had that next, and things like that happened too. You know, the unable to get out of bed and sick and seedy, and you know, at a particularly young age, it was presented, and my parents weren't happy about that. But also, you know, I was a teenage kid, and I guess you know that's problematic with a lot of parents having teenagers. You know, so that was. There were things like that were happening until I got to, I was about 19. I'd started work. I dropped out of school effectively. You know, my obsession with booze overrid my academia and I got into sort of dead-end jobs and, well, not kind of blue-collar railway work and stuff like that. And that was kind of shift work and you know, 6 days a week. And then the money was coming in and a lot of it was... and. You know, I was drinking my wage away weekly. You know, there was also the nightclubs and pubs and the whole front bar life and the early openers and all that kind of...
Started to come into it.
Cool. when I was in my sort of late teens.
Cool. We might come back after a break and talk about what happened. Welcome back. You're listening to Living's Free on... Living Free even on 3CR Community Radio 855 on the AM radio, 3CR Digital Radio, or maybe even live streaming on 3cr.org.au. Today we're talking to Don about recovery from alcoholism through Alcoholics Anonymous. And before the break, you gave us some insight into your introduction to alcohol, and maybe we'll move forward to in time and see where you're at when, you know, we talked about when it started getting troublesome, but it's a slippery slope, I hope, in my experience. So what happened from, you know, 20s onwards?
Well, when I was 19, I got quite ill, and I had... somehow, I got a bout of hepatitis and I had glandular fever at the same time. So I went to the doctor and he said to me, like, you've got to stop drinking for at least 12 months. With that statement, it felt like the rug had been pulled out from under me. You know, my solution had been removed. Even at that young age, you know, I was very concerned about how I would navigate through life. And, you know, to me, I often say that that's an example of the insanity. Like, I guess a regular Joe would follow the doctor's instructions, like, it's no big deal, stop drinking for 12 months. But even then, I found it difficult. And, you know, I did stop for a few months, and then something happened, and I just dabbled, and I started again, and... you know, I always had that shadow that was following me around, thinking that drinking could potentially kill me. But I continued to drink. Obviously, I was young enough and fit enough, and I'm here at 61 years of age. And, you know, I kind of got through it. But there was a lot of crossroads that I was coming up against that would indicate to me that...
You sort of come to a fork in the road and you go, I can go this way or I can go this way, and you sort of went, oh, alcohol still looks good.
Yes, that's exactly. And I there was all these warning signs along the way too, that, but I continued to drink. And, you know, there also, you know, my behaviour started to change. The obsession was there, and, you know, the romanticising of it, and the it becoming, you know, a part of my persona, because I was also kind of that front bar kind of guy, you know, the wild, I thought, you know, this sort of edgy, wild kind of character that I was creating in my head that, you know,
why not?
Defined me. And, you know, it, people could see through that quite quickly too, you know, and I became very distant from my family, and my mother was going through a lot of, she got sick and had, you know, cancer treatment and radiotherapy and chemotherapy, and I was probably still in my early 20s then, living at home and, you know, getting in trouble. Like, there was incidents with taxi drivers and belligerent arguments with neighbours and all this kind of coming home. No concern of it for anybody else except for myself. And the selfishness and self-centeredness, you know, was present and evidence as I, you know, I came home and you know, bounced off the walls and you know, caused stress and concern on her, and, you know, and make things, you know, unpleasant for someone that's going through this, and someone that cared about me, you know, someone that I cared about, you know, my mother. And
it's what we do, isn't it? The people around us cop us the most, that we care the most about, they cop it the worst because they're there.
Yeah.
And so what about your friendship group? Did it change, or did it burn off, or what was that?
Oh, it changed a little bit, and I kind of, by the time I was 20, 21, you know, that I kind of gravitated to some new friends, and they became friends for a long time, friends for life, I guess. And they became, some of them settled down and reinvented themselves and, you know, got partners and started, you know, getting new careers and becoming, you know, quite serious about adult life, I guess, to some degree. And I was, you know, always that kind of hedonistic sort of guy that would get the call and would go, you know, I was still kind of, you know, social, and I still had friends, and, you know, and I had a few relationships that weren't kind of long lasting. And, you know, I seemed to be accepted by people for how I was.
Mm.
And I guess that was currency or the opportunity to continue to sort of drink. And, you know, everyone would be going, oh, that's Don, you know, that's the way he is. And, you know, I guess I had sort of tolerant friends. And if you have kind of heavy drinking friends, you know, sometimes the lines do get a bit blurred. And, you know, but I was always the one under the spotlight, and sometimes, you know, how not to be. And, you know, often my friends could call it a night and have a cup of tea and put the cork in the bottle. But, you know, I'd always, because I had this phenomenon of craving, you know, once I started drinking, I didn't want to stop. And I thought it was odd that people wanted to stop, and a lot of them did.
Yeah, I guess that's the thing that we explain to the listeners, that if you're not, you know, the Alcoholics Anonymous describe alcoholism as having this physical thing that makes us different, that when we put it in our body, we can't control how much we have. It's this physical difference. And it's not just a matter of lack of willpower. It's just actually, once I physically start drinking, my brain goes, or my body processes alcohol different, and it goes, I need to have another one. I need to have another one. I need to have another one. And, you know, I don't have that experience when I buy a, you know, 24-pack of water, where I go, you know, I've got the first one, and I go, well, yeah, I'm going to get through these bottles of water. But, you know, you give me a 24-pack of, you know, a slab of beer, and once I start, I'm going to get a good way through that. You know, not because that was my intention at the start, but because that's the way I drink. Like I don't have a physical control or an off button. And then, you know, as you said about the insanity of the fact that I make a decision that I'm, because it looks pretty poor, I should stop drinking here, and I can't. Like, that's the whole problem, is that, you know, no matter what the consequences are, it doesn't matter, you know, everybody's story can get worse and worse and worse and worse, but no matter how bad it gets, the next thing is, I'm going to go and have a drink, because my brain just, my thinking is stuffed. my thinking tells me that it's going to be, next one will be different. Sorry to interrupt there. Yeah. So what happened? So what brought you to your knees?
Well, what brought me to my knees? By the time, you know, I was, there'd been a few incidents going on in life, you know, and I felt life was becoming pretty small and pretty bleak. There was late 30s, jump ahead. You know, nothing had really changed. Things had started to dissipate around me. You know, making comparisons to others. You know, everyone else seemed to be getting into a routine life, and there seemed to be this a sense of achievement, and I didn't seem to be going anywhere. But my drinking was getting worse. You know, I was drinking. I was blacking out. You know, not remembering what happened. You know, making an embarrassment of my family and to my friends. There was hostility. There was concerns and issues, what I was saying and what I was doing. I was hurting friends, hurting family. You know, my behavior wasn't getting any better. Like I thought, it began to escalate and people were getting sick and tired of me.
Was it an everyday thing at this stage?
Oh, the drinking, there was periods where it was daily, and there was periods where I was binging. Like Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
And, only 4 days a week.
and then there was kind of the whole sort of moving out, living in shared house, drinking daily when I could. You know, there was issues at work. I was getting pulled up at work because of my, you know, the hungover and seedy in the morning and, you know, making errors and mistakes and bad decisions and, you know, skating on thin ice. And you know, just this, the behaviour was embarrassing to others and to me, and the shame and guilt and kind of remorse that would happen when I wake up and being told what I did. Because I was I was often drinking publicly. I was always the guy that was the embarrassment at the Christmas party, always the guy that would, you know, do the shameful stuff at the wedding, you know, always the one that could never kind of control himself. And
so you made a decision to stop?
Well, I made a decision to stop. I woke up one morning and I thought, well, I've got to do something about this. You know, my parents were really had enough of me, but I had a few stern words from them, and I'd hurt my brother a lot, my younger brother, and he's, you know, I'd said a few things that were really kind of out of character, and he didn't deserve to be spoken to like that. And there was stuff that was continuing to happen. So I went to my GP in my late 30s and said, look, I'm just drinking too much. And I can't stop. You know, I'm drinking into blackout. You know, my health's suffering, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so I just went to the GP. I don't know, like I never went to the detox or rehab or went, kind of, I didn't know anybody that had gone down that path. So I just went to my local doctor.
And what was the outcome of that?
The outcome of that was come back and see me regularly and try and stop drinking. And I went back and saw him in a couple of weeks and I hadn't had a drink. And I went back and saw him, you know, 4 weeks later or something and I hadn't had a drink. So I just stopped and went back to see the doctor. And in that period, I made no changes or kind of really looked at anything else but just to follow that instruction. And I'd still smoke dope. I'd still go to the pub and drink Red Bull. You know, smoking cigarettes, you know, so
the lifestyle was the same.
The lifestyle was the same.
You've taken the alcohol out.
I've just taken the alcohol out. And, you know, there were moments there where I felt quite awkward and uncomfortable in that situation. And, you know, I was still this kind of shy, awkward kid, effectively. And people gave me a pat on the back and said I was doing good. So my plan then was to stop drinking for 12 months. I, in hindsight, I don't know what that was going to resolve, but I did stop drinking, but with substitutes within that period. And, you know, I picked up a drink. Someone suggested that I have a light beer, right? And I thought, okay, why not? And like, I'm doing a good job.
Just have
a
one.
I had a light beer. And then I drank a couple of light beers. Like on the Friday night, and then a week later, I was back into blackout drinking. I drank into a blackout.
Yeah.
So it was this kind of strange experience. I've never seen, none of my friends did that. The ones that drank light beers continued to drink light beer. And, you know, from then on, I didn't worry about going back to the doctor. I just continued to drink. And I tried to kind of control it in that period. But, you know, it was moving in. And I could see that it was becoming back to how it was before I stopped, you know, quite quickly. You know, and I've going to AA, I realized that, you know, I've got a progressive disease and having a rest isn't a solution or anything.
Yeah, so how old were you when you hit AA?
I was 44 years of age. So, yeah, after that experience trying to stop drinking, I drank again for a few more years and it was back into blackout drinking and nothing really changed. So I moved back home. I was living in a shared house at one stage and, you know, I got asked to leave from there from another, you know,
cool
behavioural experience from drinking. And so 44 years of age, I woke up on my bedroom floor. My mother came in and she said, look, this is something's got to change. And she was, you know, looked disgusted and embarrassed. And I knew someone from work that started going to meetings and I thought, well, I'll give this AA a go. So that Sunday morning, I went to my first AA meeting. No preparation, not really having any understanding of what I was walking into, but I walked into my first meeting on a Sunday morning.
That meeting hasn't changed in all that time either. So no, I'm saying that about a meeting. But okay, you're there. So we might take a break and then we'll talk about after the break what life looks like now. You're listening to Living Free on 3CR People Powered Radio. From paying the bills to maintaining our studios to training the next generation of community broadcasters, regular donors are vital to keeping us on air. If you're willing to become a regular donor, please go to 3cr.org.au or call the station during business hours on 9419 8377. Today we're talking with Don about alcoholism and his recovery through Alcoholics Anonymous. So what does life look like now? You joined AA, you were 40, mid-40s, and early 40s really. It's less than 45, so it's early 40s. So
44.
That's close enough. So what is life, you know, what's AA done for you?
Well, I haven't had a drink for over 16 years, so that's probably a very significant component. Happened because of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I was a fall-down blackout drunk and, you know, obsessed with drinking and coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. And there was a few things that they said to me early that, it's the first drink. And I kind of understood that. Like, I realized that once I started drinking, I found it very difficult to stop. And some people found it a bit hard to get their head around that. But I kind of got that. It was the notion of it's just for today. What I found it a bit odd because I thought, well, can I drink tomorrow?
Why not?
Yeah, so, I mean, I came to that first meeting and people there told me to keep coming back. And I'd been a guy that had been I was a guy that was kicked out of the pub often and, you know, removed from restaurants and, you know, a public nuisance and
weddings, funerals.
A public kind of embarrassment and disgrace. And I identified with what the people said and it was a local meeting and there was kind of things in that demographic that I kind of responded to, I guess. And I thought, well, I've got to do something. If nothing changes, nothing changes. And why not, you know, give it a go. And so I went back to another meeting a couple of days later. And I wasn't in a great state at that first meeting too. You know, I was still quite half affected by the booze and, you know, I was yellowed eyed and covered in psoriasis and all that. But I went to another meeting. So it kind of the next day, I was thinking about the impact of the meeting. And then I went to a meeting a day or two later, and there was someone in that meeting that I used to know from work. And I'd seen him at work and at Christmas parties and et cetera and other functions, and he never drank. And I think I used to give him a hard time about that. But and he said to me, you're in the right place. I've seen you drink. And I kind of that sort of confirmed something. And initially in the first few weeks of going to meetings, I was trying to do my own approach to it, I guess. You know, people were very enthusiastic, and I was quite, you know, by then in sort of mid-40s, very disconnected, I guess. And but I, as I said, I knew I had to do something, and I thought, well, why not? And try here, start here. And within a few kind of weeks of going to meetings irregularly, infrequently, I something registered, and I bought a big book, probably, you know, in the first couple of weeks, and
so big books, what AA people call, so Alcoholics Anonymous started from a book. It's the first 100 people that got sober wrote a book, and they called it Alcoholics Anonymous, and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous grew out of the name of the book, but we call it the big book where, because it's a big book.
Yeah.
And because that's as imaginative as we can get.
Yeah. So I bought the book, and I read what, you know, I read the book on my own effectively, and you know, there wasn't a lot of retaining the information, but I realized there was something in that reading. This was probably in the first 2 or 3 weeks, and I got more serious about AA and not drinking and going to meetings. There was something there. There was something positive in that, and sort of connecting with others. The more I went back, the more frequently the meetings, and people got to know me, and the more involved from the outsider, I made a decision to, and with the suggestion of others, to step closer within in the framework of Alcoholics Anonymous.
There's a real social side to it. Like when you first get there, you know, you're sort of hanging out with other people who've had the same experiences, because we don't talk about our drinking, like the horror stories of our drinking, with other people. Like it's not water cooler conversation. Like, what did you do on the weekend? I go, well, I wet the bed. You know, it's not the conversation you're having with people at work. But when you get there and, you know, there's this commonality of the common problem, and then there's a sense of, you know, joviality or whatever it is that you're sort of going, wow, and people are laughing and they're smiling and they're looking pretty happy about not drinking, and it's attractive.
Yep.
And that's certainly my experience.
And definitely, and there was that aspect too. If these people are happy and they drank like me, you know, perhaps I can do this. And there's moments, particularly in those first few early days, where I found it quite daunting, because I was a bit of a stranger in a strange land, and I hadn't really had much of any ideas to change the way I was, or how to reinvent myself, or go on any path of discovery, or any sort of mental health aspects to check or look at. You know, I just came to a meeting and, you know, I got involved. And within time, I did what was suggested. You know, I got a service. Got a home group. And
so home group, somewhere you go every week, and you go, you know, you make yourself known. You can explain it as you go.
Okay, and I got a sponsor who was a mentor and a guide through the work and through the 12 steps. You know, I did regular frequent meetings, and going through the process of the 12 steps was something I'd never done before, and I've never really had any spiritual activity or connection or really had any other inspirational elements in my life until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and did what was suggested. And it was really, I look back in those early days and a bit lost, and coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, it's really developed into me what, you know, how I can be of benefit to others. And I guess the big primary purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. So it's given me a purpose too, which, someone that was, you know, a fall down, blackout, lost soul coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, there was that, you know, transformational part.
Yeah, it's the opportunity to do something different like that. I think that AA has really shown me that self-sufficiency has failed me, whereas I've never looked outside, as you said, to look outside to see what I need to do. Because self-sufficiency is what I go to. You know, I've always gone to, I'll look after it, and then I get the results. And I look at, and AA's asked me to look at the results and go, it's pretty poor, you're in AA. And then you go, oh, okay, we got something different. And it doesn't look like it's a solution to the problem, because you look like you've got a drinking problem. And they're going to go and show you that that drinking is actually the solution to your living problem. And I go, and they offer you this living solution. And I didn't know that what was on offer here. That's not advertised well, that AA is a living solution, you know, a life solution rather than a drinking solution. And, yeah, and it gives us some practical stuff to do. And part of that is, as you said, getting useful.
Yep, exactly. And that's right. And being of service. And it's helped transform my life too. You know, there was kind of, I don't know if I'm on the spectrum or what, but there's things that people find quite easy to do to me. And I've always found them quite difficult in some ways. And, you know, coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's given me a connection to a power that's given me a confidence and that I didn't have without a drink. You know, the artificial confidence was presented to me when I was drinking, but I never really used that for any kind of beneficial, just to be a lair and a, you know, a pain in the ass to everybody else. But being of service and trying to be helpful and being able to pause when agitated and, you know, thinking about others and developing an empathy and...
So what does that look like in real life? So how do you fit into your family now? What's your relationship with your brother and your mum's like?
I lost my father in sobriety. He actually died of cancer. My mother's still around, so I can be of service to my mother. You know,
she's very cool. I watched cricket with her yesterday. Did enjoy that a lot.
You know, my brothers in my life, we get on, you know, a lot better than we did. You know, I lost my father, so I also, you know, that gave me the Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the ability to stand up and be present and be helpful and not run and hide and drink like, you know, I would have in my previous life. You know, I couldn't drive a car. I learned to drive a car when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I hadn't been anywhere around the world except for Bali in the 80s. And, you know, I've travelled the world because I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been to countries and gone to meetings overseas. You know, there's been relationships with people that are far deeper and more, you know, more. There's a closeness that I hadn't felt before. You know, I've had friends and life's been up and down. You know, there's been challenges and experiences that have been quite negative too. But I've got through that without having a drink, because I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in a previous, as I said previously, I wouldn't have been able to navigate through these things. And even recently, you know, I'm on leave at the moment and there's been kind of one thing after another.
Well, hang on. Just I want to talk about, so I know you. So, okay. So people think that we come to AA and then the drinking's all, like, we've got to separate ourselves from it. But I'm watching your T-shirt. I know you, you know, you hang out in places that alcohol is served. Like, that's my experience with you, is that we go and see bands. We do things like it. We haven't separated ourselves from the life of people who drink. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. Yeah, because I'm you know, I'm always been into a fan of music, and I like live music. I like to support local music. I like, you know, international, you know, that I'm of an age where, you know, it was through the punk, alternative, post-punk, all that kind of life, world, yep. Music. And I go out and see those bands and, you know, classic rock bands, and it's always been there. And, you know, it's something that's quite fulfilling and exciting, and, you know, I can do that sober. And then there's people that are around in those situations that drink, and, you know, we can go to licensed venues. I can go anywhere along. And also I see a reflection in them that, you know, how I don't want to be at times too, you know.
Apparently they've just changed the carpet at the old bar again. So, like, I know we've had sticky feet there.
Yes.
and a few occasions. So
yeah, definitely. No, that's the thing. Like, it's there's a lot of fun. You know, it's not all
just
total altruistic life, but there is a lot of fun, and there's a lot of things I can do, and you know, I've been able to do that because of Alcoholics Anonymous and because of being sober and because I'm in recovery, and it's to help others. And you know, I share at rehabs and detoxes, and you know that. That's a big element, and you know, I still go to regular and frequent meetings. That, you know, I sponsor guys, and you know, have the service position and above group level at the moment. And
yeah, good life.
It's definitely a good life. You know,
awesome.
I've got a job, and you know, I'm not
responsible.
I'm not in any debt.
Thank you. Really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you,
really
Michael.
Really enjoyed listening to you. So that's all the time we've got today. So I'd like to thank Don for coming into the studios and sharing his experience of recovery with us.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.